This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, Dr. Anthony Monteiro says the U.S. political and economic system is coming apart at the seams, with the ruling class fighting among itself. And that's one reason the Democrats seem to have gone crazy over the imagined Russian threat. We'll talk with Dr. Monteiro about the Democrats' disarray and the larger crisis of capitalism. But first, we'll present some remarks by Paul Street, the activist, author, and educator who's been a longtime critic of Barack Obama. Paul Street pegged Obama early on as a profoundly conservative politician. Street recently spoke at the Open University of the Left in his hometown of Chicago. He talked about why the Democrats and their allies in the intelligence services are trying to destabilize the Donald Trump presidency before he's even sworn into office.
I think that a key part of the foreign policy establishment, bipartisan, Republican and Democratic alike, is really concerned that Trump is too close to Putin and is going to stand back from the new Cold War that all kinds of military-industrial complex interests are heavily invested in vis-a-vis Russia. So it's a way of keeping the heat on Moscow after Trump gets in there. And I think they're going to find that irresistible. So you're going to hear about the Russia hacked thing forever. And there's also a my dog ate my homework aspect to blaming the election on external Russian influence. See, it's not that we suck, the Democrats. It's not that we're a right-wing corporate neoliberal party beholden to the nation's unelected and interrelated dictatorships of money and empire. It's not that we abandon the working class and the causes of social justice and peace decades ago, right? Back beyond the Clintons. Ralph Nader dates it to the Carter administration. No, it's not of that, you see. We don't really have to change. It's a way of avoiding a confrontation with the right-wing Wall Street captive party that they've become, right? So it's a way of keeping forces of reform internal to their own party. Can't really blame the Green Party. The numbers don't add up. The blame Russia thing is bizarre, and yet it's going to be pervasive. Here's another thing I think not to blame. There was a big, nasty, mean uprising of vicious, white, sexist, racist, nativist, bigoted, working class Americans, those that Hillary Clinton so famously called a basket of deplorables. There was no big Rust Belt rebellion of the white working class. It didn't actually happen. It is a kind of pervasive narrative. Trump's working class support is way, way oversold in media. And of course, is anyone else here gotten irritated about how much the white working class and the working class have become conflated with one another, as if there aren't millions of African American and Latino and other ethnic groups in the working class? But it's way overstated. The real story is that the GOP got pretty much its usual share of whites without college degrees and whites below 50K a year. But Democrats lost those voters to non-voting. The Democrats' loss of such voters, white working class voters, and, you know, we don't have a precise exit poll category called working class, so without college degree or 50K and less are your usual stands-in. Democrats' loss of such voters was three times Republicans' gain of such voters between 2012 and 2016. And by the way, one thing that exit poll data shows to me beyond the shadow of a doubt is that Bernie Sanders would in all likelihood have been able to defeat Donald Trump, I mean, in the absence of shenanigans around vote counts that frankly don't have anything to do with Russia at all. There's a whole history of problems with how votes are counted that Greg Palast and who's that Green Party guy in Ohio, Bob Fritakis, the expert on how the voting machines are set up? You know, we didn't need Russia to intervene somehow automatically to have issues with how votes are tabulated. Now, you know, one external factor that I don't think is just the dog ate my homework for the Democrats is the Comey thing. Now, that really was an absolutely remarkable thing. The James Comey, there's, by tradition, been a 60-day rule that federal law enforcement does not say anything prejudicial towards a presidential candidate. You know, I think it's a 60-day rule, you know, leading up to the election. That kind of vague thing that Comey did, where he said, wait a minute, no, maybe there is a problem, without any real evidentiary substance. You know, the Democrats are trying to do with the CIA thing about the Russians, kind of what the Republicans did to what Hillary threw Comey, right? No smoking gun, not entirely clear exactly what we're talking about. I think that might have mattered. I think that Comey thing might have mattered. I don't know if it mattered so much with the popular vote per se as it mattered with it was kind of a signal, maybe even to the establishment, that Hillary Clinton was just going to be too flawed a candidate to get the establishment agenda through. You know, I think there's a role of the left, so-called, in electing Donald Trump and in defeating Democrats, too. And one of those roles is just this insistent, tired, constant, again and again, nauseating, once every 4 years counsel from leading left luminaries to practice lesser evil voting, which I noticed this time people just couldn't take with a lot of young leftists. They just couldn't listen to it, and a lot of older leftists couldn't take it anymore. And one of the problems with it, in my opinion, is that it incentivizes the Democrats to be awful once every 4 years. It becomes a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy. I mean, why should they stop being terrible, horrible, awful, corporate, neoliberal imperialists when they know that once every 4 years, Noam Chomsky and other left luminaries are going to be there to catch their electoral back and are going to be ready to ride on the back of that Harley, You know, roared by the Democrats with their arms around the Democratic candidate. Yeah, right. Muttering and pissed off and not happy. You know, but they're still riding on the back of that bike, you know, with their nose averted so they don't have to smell who they're riding around with. And it just becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. So why should the Democratic Party be any different? And then the Democratic Party is so bad that it opens the barn door for the Republicans to win the next time around. And as the Democratic Party gets further right, the Republican Party gets further right, and the Republican Party gets so awful that left luminaries go, oh, my God, look how awful the Republican Party is. And it just never ends. It's just like this vicious circle. It's like this endless descent into hell and the self-fulfilling prophecy. I think the other thing, when we buy into electoralism and this deadly definition of politics, that Chomsky has written about quite brilliantly, right? This horrible definition of politics as we go in a voting booth. And he's against this, by the way. You know, we go in a voting booth once every 4 years, and we mark a ballot, and then we go home and let other people run the world. And I always say, let rich bastards run the world into the ground. Or I put an I into the word run and say, ruin the world. And that's literally happening now with the Trump administration. It's going to happen with the Trump administration. So many of us have, especially liberals I know, have bought into that dominant definition of politics, that there's none of that street heat, that thunder on the left, that social movement pressure to make the Democratic Party be any better and to be the type of party that might actually not lose election. Hillary did her job. Mark my words, Hillary would have preferred besting Bernie in the primaries and losing to Trump in the general. She would prefer that scenario to losing to Bernie in the primaries and Bernie winning the general election. I can't prove it, obviously, but I feel very confident in that statement. That's their job, the mainstream top, the people still in charge of the Democratic Party. First and foremost is to destroy progressives in their own ranks. That's one thing that really leaped out of the WikiLeaks data dumps. Public service, you know, by Vladimir Putin. Don't get me wrong. I hope if we're not going to have third parties in this country and the Constitution is incredibly hostile and the setup is very hostile to third parties, well, then I would hope they would make it, but I'm not holding my breath. Avoid this narrative. You can't oppose Trump if you didn't oppose Obama. Get over it. It is irritating that people are too acquiescent with Democrats in. But now that you got Trump in there, it's a new game. He's a president now. Okay? I was relentless towards George W. Bush. I don't, just because I hate the dismal dollar Democrats doesn't mean I give Republicans a free pass either. Work with it. Work with the resistance against Donald Trump and try and make it the kind of resistance that can't just be hijacked by Democratic Party electorate.
There still is something kind of left and populist about Trump.
No, there isn't. Don't ever think there is. Don't fall for that. I mean, it's amazing how many, some of my fellow writers in Counterpunch seem to think there's like something really genuinely anti-war, genuinely populist in Trump. Here's another narrative to be careful about. The establishment hates Trump. Really? Finance capital is like water in the basement. It just kind of runs to power. Whoever it is, he's making damn sure to put Goldman Sachs in intensive presidency as ever. The Financial Services Roundtable is picking up the transition team expenses. Bank of America, Goldman, and the other stocks are having a bull run. They've been having a field day ever since Trump got in. They're willing to work with him. I mean, I think there's some issues. I think that it's not all going to go away. Ultimately, he may become unuseful to them. Don't get me wrong. But right now, they're going to do a honeymoon. And why shouldn't they? He is promising significant direct financial, environmental deregulation, and significant personal and corporate tax reductions. Trump is anti-war. Well, I already did that. No, he isn't. We're probably less likely to have a war with Russia than we would have with Hillary right now. But we're just going to double down on conflicts with Iran, and there's all kinds of issues coming up with China, which is also a nuclear power, and so on and so forth. Here's another narrative to avoid. All resistance to Trump is funded by George Soros and MoveOn.org. You know, some is going to be. Some has been already. Some is going to be. I mean, if George Soros wants to write me a big, fat check, I'll put my information up for direct deposit in my bank, with just the understanding I'm going to do a goddamn thing he tells me, right? But people are going to have all kinds of everyday, organic, rank-and-file, direct, social, historical reasons and experiences that are going to lead them to be angry at Trump and to fight against Trump. They don't need George Soros to make them angry against Trump. Okay? Pipeline fighters facing off against militarized police as Trump comes to privatize Indian reservations in 2017 and 2018. Don't need George Soros to make them angry at Donald Trump. Immigrants fighting against, you know, INS roundups and deportations. Don't need MoveOn.org. I mean, so beware. I'm somewhat suspicious of our revolution by Bernie Sanders. I really don't know entirely what to make of it. I have a feeling that, you know, I mean, so it's a balancing act. But don't just assume. It just becomes this way of being passive. Here's another narrative, my last narrative for avoiding. I'm hearing this a lot now, that what happened to Hillary Clinton shows that we should avoid and reject anything and everything related to identity of race, of gender, of ethnicity, and sexual orientation. Well, I would be very careful about that. Bernie Sanders has kind of said sort of things like that that sort of suggests. I'd be very careful about rejecting identity politics briefly. There's a debased and bourgeois and corporate neoliberal version of identity politics, and there's a left progressive socialist version of dealing with identity. Right? And the left has always worked with the specific experience and oppression of specific groups who, yes, are divided. And there's a whole divide and rule system under capitalism. But it isn't about squelching the specificity of black oppression or the specificity of immigrant oppression or the specificity of Latino aggression or gay oppression or transgendered oppression. You need to talk truth about what specific and real about what's happening to subgroups so they can see their experience and identity on the solidaristic banner. I say work with identity in a way that gets you to class.
That was author, educator, and activist Paul Street speaking at the Open University of the Left in Chicago. Back in October and early November, when almost everybody else was predicting a landslide victory for Hillary Clinton, political activist and educator Dr. Anthony Montero was saying Donald Trump stood a real chance of winning the White House. Dr. Montero is a Du Boisian scholar and a member of the Black Radical Organizing Committee in Philadelphia. We asked him why the Democrats are attacking the incoming Trump administration from the right and blaming the Russians and domestic critics for Hillary Clinton's defeat.
Well, it tells us very clearly that they're in a state of panic. If you put together Brexit and the defeat of Hillary Clinton on November 8th, we could say that like a boxer who took a blow to the liver, the system has buckled and it's trying to regain its legs so it can go forward. But in all seriousness, they're in a state of panic. They don't know what to do. And in fact, if you take into account the stage of the crisis of capitalism, their responses and the election itself is a manifestation of what is in all probability the beginning of the deterioration and disintegration of the system itself.
For some time now, the system itself, under the Democrats and the Republicans, has seemed incapable of envisioning or proposing anything of substance that would stop the continuing decline of the standards of living of the American people.
Yes, it's more than a political problem, and it will not be resolved through the political process. You know, Lenin kind of conceptualize this stage of capitalism, the stage that we're in, as imperialism. And, you know, he said imperialism is not a policy, it is a discrete stage in the development of capitalism. And others have spoken of stages in the general crisis. And I would argue that we're in the fifth stage of the general crisis of capitalism. This stage began in 2008 with the Great Recession and continues. And I think what characterizes this stage as opposed to other stages is that the breakdown of the system in its most profound senses occurred mainly on the peripheries of the core nations and economies of capitalism. For example, Lenin called it the weak links of the world system. For example, Russia, China, Cuba. But the core of the system has up until this point been able to, even in crisis, regain its footing and to stabilize itself. I think we're looking at something very, very different this time around, where the crisis in its most profound and deepest senses is hitting at the core countries of the world capitalist system. And I think that is what the election is a manifestation of. I think that's what Brexit is a manifestation of. And I think that's what the general political chaos in the Western economies is a manifestation of.
All indications are that it's later than most people think for capitalism. Certainly it is for U.S. imperialism. The politics and the economy are going haywire right here in the very heart of the imperial system.
Absolutely, and that's my point. And that is a reflection of the current, or what I am calling the fifth stage of the general crisis. And you are right. It is later in the day than most people thought. And hence, the political discourse around, for instance, the reformers of the Democratic Party, we have to get closer to the working class. That's what Bernie Sanders and Keith Ellison and people like them are saying. Or you get what is more or less a left discourse about the arrival or the inauguration of Trump or the victory of Trump represented the onset of fascism. And I think all of that overlooks what is in fact a systemic or existential crisis at the very core of the global system of capitalism.
With capitalism in such bad shape, I suppose that radicals ought to be happy, but it's also a very dangerous period, isn't it?
Right. But, you know, the interesting thing is, rather than being happy or seeing opportunities, most radicals see this only in terms of foreboding and danger. It is frightening in some ways because the future is not guaranteed. There are many dangers, but at the same time, there are opportunities as well. The question is whether or not a serious left can emerge in this country and certainly in the African-American community and in the African-American struggle that understands that we must think strategically. We cannot look back to the 1930s and analogize what is happening now to then, because we're in a different moment in history, a different epoch, if you will, that in fact, we must think strategically. And we can no longer be guided, I guess I would say, by hysterical thinking, subjectivism, and wishful thinking. The good old days are not going to return. And this will be perhaps a long and protracted period of crisis, of struggle, of social deterioration, of economic disintegration, of even the possibility in a country like ours of something that looks close to civil war, if not civil unrest, for a prolonged period of time.
Most of the ruling class is gathered under the Democratic banner these days, now that Donald Trump is at least the nominal head of the Republican Party. And we see that it's the Democrats who have reversed recent history by attacking the top Republican from the right and calling for war and more war.
That's right. That's right. And that is their answer to their problems, war and domestic repression. This is the reason for the whole thing about fake news and fake news sites and Russian agents and Russia is a threat to, quote, our democracy, end quote. All of that is but a manifestation of a great crisis at the level of the ruling class because there's not hardly any space to reform the system. You know, in another way of putting it, you know, the ruling class have backed themselves into a corner. And in that corner, they're still, you know, the ruling class and still thieves and still stealing. And, you know, most of the income and wealth is going to them in huge amounts these days. But they have no room to maneuver. And the political options that existed previously don't exist for them any longer.
You talked about the fifth stage of capitalism and the dangers and the opportunities that are inherent in that stage. But what's the world supposed to do to avoid being torn apart, savaged by desperate imperialism in decline?
Let me put it this way. I believe that monopoly capitalism must be undone, must be broken up. The banks have to be broken up, large parts of them nationalized. In other words, a profound and fundamental end to the neoliberal order globally, to the policies of neoliberalism, a retreat from empire and from war, a seizing of the military budget and turning it towards economic development and jobs and a green economy. We're talking about a fundamental reshaping of the world economy beginning with a fundamental reshaping of the U.S. economy and the beginning of a transition away from neoliberal capitalism to what we could call mid-21st century socialism, or at least a form of highly regulated state capitalism.
The conventional wisdom has been that the U.S., which is the headquarters of imperialism, would be the last bastion of reaction, the last wall to come tumbling down.
Yes, but it might be the first to fall in this process, the first domino. You know, it's hard to predict how it will happen. However, it is clear that we're in a stage of history where this kind of fundamental change is necessary. In fact, it will be increasingly demanded by the population of the United States and the other major capitalist countries.
President Obama is on his way out the door. What kind of difference do you think he made in his 8 years in office, besides being black, of course?
Well, no difference. I mean, he played by the script, and he did what he was told. And at the end of the day, the economy, in terms of the majority of people, is worse now than when he assumed the presidency. Over the last 8 years, 95% of the jobs that were created were part-time or non-permanent jobs. The economy's growth has been at a level below 2% and sometimes below 1.5%, which is almost stagnation. And now we're on the cusp of another recession, perhaps, certainly a stock market bubble bursting. And he has made no difference. In fact, many people argue correctly that it is his extreme neoliberal policies that have led to the great rebellion that produced the presidency of Donald Trump.
One could say, and some people have said, that Barack Obama oversaw the restructuring of the U.S. economy after the Great Recession by saving the banks, but at the same time created new levels of precariousness for just about everybody else, and that this has been especially harmful to the folks who were already in a precarious position, like black Americans.
Yes, that's absolutely true. He has not been a good president, even for his most loyal base, the African American people. In fact, African Americans as a people are poorer today than they were at the beginning of the Obama presidency. It is a sorry record. And the only thing that has kind of held him up is that the entire propaganda machinery of Wall Street has been behind him and created of him some type of celebrity, which they fed to people rather than to give them jobs and education and real health care. He's been a failure, an abject failure, and he leaves after his party, the party that he has led, suffered an ignominious defeat to a candidate who was the most unlikely presidential candidate, who only had one-tenth of the money that his opponent Clinton had and didn't have hardly any organization and certainly didn't even have the Republican Party with him. But on top of that, his party suffered even further defeats in both houses of Congress, in state legislatures and governorships and so on. So politically, Barack Obama's leadership of the Democratic Party has been an abject failure. But in terms of the real life conditions of the majority of working people, irrespective of race, but specifically of African Americans, it is worse now than when Obama came into office.
Some would say that Barack Obama has been very successful if his job was to save the banks and if his job was to restructure the economy to serve the rich better and if his job was to stack the odds against the 99%, that he has, in fact, been quite successful.
That's right. He has been successful in that regard. but the success dialectically has produced another level of the crisis of capitalism, if that makes sense. I mean, by succeeding in immiserating and impoverishing the working class, he has also produced the conditions for the working class insurgency that we saw in 2016.
So when the capitalists get what they want in terms of public policy, it creates the conditions that inflame the rest of us.
That's why I said earlier that the ruling class had backed itself into a corner out of which it has no way out. It can't get out of this corner. And hence, a constant and prolonged attack upon their rule in many different ways by broad sections of the working masses, the middle class, the youth. And this is across the capitalist world, from Europe to the United States and Canada. I mean, this is huge. This is something that we have never experienced, even in the Great Depression, and it is something that few of us had ever imagined possible.
And now we have a situation, at least in foreign policy, where the two corporate parties have reversed roles on war and peace, and neither of those parties commands the respect of the American people.
That's right. And again, this is a great crisis of legitimacy. The ruling elite have lost their legitimacy to rule increasingly, and they're fighting tooth and nail to regain it. However, all of the major institutions are, in one or another way, according to polling data, at the lowest levels of support in the history of polling. Take, for example, the president of France, Hollande. His positive ratings are something under 10% in the single digits, even though the propaganda media in this country have kind of propped Obama up in the last year of his presidency. He was unable to kind of lead his party to victory. And it wasn't just because Hillary Clinton was a poor candidate. It had a lot to do with the fact that masses of people, tens of millions of people, reject the rule of the neoliberal managers and the neoliberal elite. And that is the verdict of 2016. And I think that trend will continue into 2017. Now, whether or not, by voting against what is, that is a mandate to govern in a positive way, that is not yet certain. Indeed, can Trump govern? Can he live up to the promises that he made to working people for jobs and not war? I don't think so. First of all, the neoliberal elite at the highest levels are not going to allow him to govern. And that's what all of this Russia hacking and Trump, an apologist for Putin, all of that talk is all about. They will not allow him to govern. But in not allowing him to govern, they will only create new conditions of the delegitimation of the neoliberal elite and of the neoliberal order. If they would back off, because what he's talking about in terms of the domestic economy, a lot of ways, is reform and new kind of arrangements in terms of international trade. Very contradictory. A lot of ways, I don't think he knows what the hell he's talking about. But the fact of the matter is, what the people want is some basic changes in the economic rules that do not just favor Wall Street and the 0.1%. They want a redistribution of wealth. They want investment in jobs in this country. They want an end to policies of regime change and nation building and intervention. They want something different. Now, can Trump deliver? I doubt it. But in not being able to deliver, it only intensifies the political crisis itself.
The corporate media are certainly part of the current madness, and they tend to paint the political crisis in partisan Democratic and Republican colors.
That's right. But isn't it, at a certain level, a struggle within the ruling elite? But even more than that, there seems to be a deep struggle within the deep state itself, within the security apparatus of the state. This is huge. And that is alongside the growing contradiction and struggle between the masses of people and the 1%.
It's just been amazing to witness U.S. intelligence agencies fighting among themselves in public, trying to undermine each other through the press and in the media. Most notably, the CIA clearly squaring off against the FBI. That is unheard of.
Yes, and a president-elect attacking the CIA. I mean, we've never seen this, where the system is attacking itself, almost like cancer or HIV attacks the system itself. This is viral, a viral attack from within the system. And we've never seen it, Glenn. And we cannot look back for explanations, backward in history, to explain this. We have to explain this situation on its own terms, and we have to understand what is happening, not based on the past, but based upon what appears to be probable and almost inevitable. That is the disintegration of the system from within.
The international scene seems to be alive with the possibilities for new alignments and maybe new disasters. The U.S. pivoting towards China, moving against Russia, maybe preparing for an expanded war in the Middle East.
Or naval exercises between Russia and the Philippines. Or the Philippines asking, demanding that the U.S. military forces leave their country. Or Turkey, the president of Turkey, Erdogan, suggesting that he is considering joining the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, a military economic organization led by Russia and China. Or the strategic alliance between Russia and China. Or the destabilization of South Korea. It's everywhere. The undoing of a system that has been in place for over 70 years that the U.S. devised after World War II. The IMF, the European Union, NATO, the World Bank, all of these institutions are in crisis and on the cusp of collapse.
The Democrats claim that news outlets that they say are under the influence of the Russians are undermining the image of the United States, making the U.S. look bad and the U.S. economic and political system look bad. And yet, America's reputation in the world has been going down for a long time.
Absolutely. And they can call it fake news all they want, but the polls from nation to nation and on a world scale, the United States and its policies are isolated. The world rejects the leadership of a single hegemonic power, in this case, the United States. What the world wants is a multipolar world where nations and societies with differing social economic systems can live in peace. The world wants investment in the development of industry and green economies and feeding and caring for the masses of people. The U.S. ruling elite cannot offer this, and hence the United States is increasingly isolated. You know, in one way, we could talk about this as an ambitious and precocious nation, having overplayed their hand, having gone way beyond anything that was possible, and now reaping the whirlwind. The world now rejects this ambitious and precocious hegemon and are demanding that it retreat and open up space for the people of the world to reinvent and recreate humanity.
When people talk about the crisis of capitalism, if they talk about the crisis of capitalism, most think in terms of the imminent demise of the system. But actually, the nature of capitalism is to generate crises periodically.
Yes, definitely. But again, we must contextualize it. This is a reflection of the fifth stage of the general crisis of capitalism. And this goes back to the 1870s. So you're right, it's almost 150 years since this crisis first began. And of course, it has led to great depressions, wars of unimaginable horror, but also it has led to revolutions and national liberation struggles, and so on and so forth, the decolonization of Asia and Africa. So these 150 years have been dramatic, and I think we are close to talking about the end game of a system. And the question is how the unraveling will occur. Will it be long and miserable, a kind of metaphorical dark ages? Or will it come quickly and relatively painlessly? Can we do this without another world war? Can we avoid another Great Depression? Can we transition away from this horrible system to what is more humane and just, in a way that does not produce collateral damage and tens, if not hundreds, of millions of casualties? This is what we have to consider. And of course, to achieve a more peaceful transition requires a new type of leadership of the people in labor, in the Black community, in the Latino communities, among women, among youth, among all sections of the population, but a principled leadership, a leadership that approximates the example of Fidel Castro, that type of vanguard, that type of humanism, that type of from the people and back to the people. And people will respond positively to it. But it's going to be difficult. It's going to be a perilous path forward, because systems, especially when they've achieved this level of wealth and power, don't easily give up.
Well, certainly the task before us is daunting, to say the least. But the U.S. anti-war movement is nothing like it used to be. And even the reemergence of Black social movement politics, it's only a couple of years old. So how can we build the kind of movement that we need, the kind of movement that the world needs us to create?
In our lifetime, we saw the civil rights movement, which was, in fact, in its overarching sense, a conversation about the future of race in the country. You know, that's why Martin Luther King is so huge, because he was able to articulate and create space for a discourse about the future of the nation. That discourse on civil rights, because it was about the future, intersected with a discourse about poverty and war. Again, he framed it. The anti-Vietnam War movement was a discourse on war and peace and foreign intervention and the draft and domestic benefits from an economy which would demilitarize. And that was a positive. The Occupy Wall Street was a discursive space created by a small group of people. The meaning of that discourse is still with us and influencing thinking. The Black Lives Matter movement, discourses on police brutality. At the end of the day, over 50% of black young people prefer socialism, and a growing number of white young people say they prefer socialism over capitalism. I think we are in a moment of great conversation, of great discourse. Don't look to the corporate media for evidence of it, but in communities, in churches, in schools, in unions, throughout this country, people are carrying on discussions similar to the ones that we are having right now. Most people discuss all of this in relationship to their immediate needs. We, of course, have a little more theoretical background, so we can connect more of the dots and more of the variables. But I am convinced, yes, it will occur. Will it be a discourse led by what is currently defined or self-defined as the left? I don't think what is currently self-defined as the left, which is pretty much white, is capable of leading that conversation. But I do believe from the people themselves, from their own experiences, be it in Black Lives Matter, be it in Occupy, be it in the Bernie Sanders movement, be it in the last election to bring the Clinton machine down, new leaders, new thought leaders, new intellectual vanguards will emerge. That I'm hopeful of. Now, how they stand up in the face of unimaginable repression and attacks upon dissent is something that I can't predict.
And as you said, the tools at this regime's disposal, the tools for surveillance and repression, are like nothing before seen on Earth.
Oh, yes. And that's their form of political rule: intimidation, terrorism, dirty tricks of every sort. See, that is why I think that we would help ourselves by, for the time being, discarding the words fascism, neo-fascism, and so on from our political lexicon. First of all, the words are used so broadly that they have come to mean very, very little. The other thing is that the form of state rule that we are living under would have been unimaginable to the Nazis in Germany. They had nothing like the control of the minds and lives and movements of the population of Germany compared to what our rulers have over us. We live in a totalitarian state, the likes of which humanity has never seen, because of the technology that is available to the ruling class. So to call this fascism, I think we're at something way beyond that, way beyond that. And we just don't have a word for it appropriately, a word for it to describe it.
The new McCarthyism has arrived. It comes complete with blacklists and even a newly created Ministry of Truth. But there are voices from all over the political spectrum that are opposing the status quo in this country. It's not just the left. It seems that the rulers are simply producing more dissent.
And that's the contradiction. And it is because of the sense of losing their control that they put in place more controls. But then they put in place more controls, but then you have people that become whistleblowers that betray the very systems that they work for and use the technology against the system. Not to mention how all of this antagonizes the sensibilities and the sense of well-being of broad masses of people. You know, it's interesting, with all of their control of the media and social media and technology and all of that, they have not convinced the people, and I would argue the majority of people, that their rule is either just or democratic or humane or, in fact, necessary.
The Democrats weren't the only losers in November. The corporate press was overwhelmingly rooting for Hillary Clinton.
No question. And look, the entire corporate media Silicon Valley, not to mention Wall Street, were all behind Hillary Clinton, the entire ruling class, even the security agencies, in particular the CIA, were behind Hillary Clinton. And they went down. They lost. What does that say about the power, in this instance specifically, of the media over the opinions and thoughts and attitudes of the masses of people? They've lost it. And I don't think they can regain it. And that's why I believe that a new moment in the ideological and consciousness development of the people is before us. I think this is an opportunity. It's not a time to be afraid. It is a time to seize the moment, to go to the people, to understand the people, to listen to the people, to establish every kind of forum to discuss, to learn, to educate at every level, to do this among children and youth, elderly people, among the unemployed and poor. This is an opportunity the likes of which we have never experienced in our lifetimes, a moment that is far more pregnant with possibility than the 60s and 70s. And all we have to do is have the courage to take advantage of it.
That was Du Boisian scholar Dr. Anthony Montero in Philadelphia. The new year brings little in the way of improvement to the lives of the 2.3 million Americans in prison, the largest gulag in the world. Political prisoners like Khalafani Malik Khaldun at Indiana's Wabash Valley State Prison are under constant pressure, as he explains for Prison Radio.
For the past 3 weeks, the prison crats at Wabash Valley Correctional Facility have been engaging in a series of internal raids on targeted prisoner cells. Several political prisoner cells were hit with drug-sniffing dogs and walk-through metal detectors, searching for drugs and cell phones. The top brass controlling the raids advised me several days ago that I was now the most influential prisoner at this prison. They threatened me, saying that if I didn't stop the proliferation of meth and synthetic drugs spreading throughout the prison, they had orders to put me and 10 of my comrades in solitary confinement. They tore my cell up 3 times in 2 weeks with the dogs and found nothing. One night I was going out to recreation to exercise, and several officers surrounded me, placing me in handcuffs, and escorted me to the officer's conference room, made me get butt-ass naked, and found nothing again. The following day, my cell was targeted again. Nothing was found. Shortly after the cell search, they conducted a drug screen to see if they could get me on a dirty drug screen. I provided a sample that they claimed failed to register. So they advised me that an additional test would occur the next day. They found no drugs of any kind in this sample. Instead of running a second test, the sergeant who took the test filed a Class B conduct report against me, claiming I failed to provide an adequate sample, which is bogus. They're needing to set me up for anything they can. When they say that you failed to provide a sample, they're saying that it wasn't enough urine. While I was asleep in bed, 3 officers descended upon my cell, ordering me to allow them to cuff me behind my back. This occurred on January 5th, 2017. They told me they were ordered by the superintendent to take me to solitary confinement. I am currently being held in segregation at this moment for no legitimate reason. I plead with all my comrades, college students, and revolutionary organizations to let your voices be heard. Stand with me against another vicious campaign to silence my fight for freedom, justice, and equality. by making me out to be running some form of a drug ring inside this prison in an attempt to destroy my political credibility as an activist on the inside. Demand that they release me or transfer me to a prison where I can be left alone. Can your complaints can be sent in to Superintendent Dick Brown at 812-398-5050, extension 4101. Also, Assistant Superintendent Frank Littlejohn, 812-398-5050, extension 4502. Internal Affairs, Ms. Jordina Rainey, at 812-398-5050, extension 4262. This is Indiana Political Prison, Calfani Malik Caldoun. I need your help. Stand with me in solidarity and expose what is going on. Thank you. God bless and power to the people.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.